Podcast Network Asia.
Welcome to She Talks Peace, a podcast that highlights the role of women peace builders around the world in bringing lasting peace and security to communities, eavesdrop on their communities, and get to know their stories. From the Philippines to Malaysia, from Indonesia to Palestine, from Myanmar to the United States, their dreams and hopes for a world without violence and a world where every woman and girl can be whoever she wants to be. Hosted by Amina Rasul Bernardo, President of the Philippine Center for Islam and Democracy. This is She Talks Peace.
Salam, salam, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of She Talks Peace. I'm delighted to be with you today. My name is Attorney Mirabel Cristobal. I am joining you from Manila. To our returning listeners, you might find me familiar since I've had the pleasure of being a guest before and engaging with you. But today, I'm stepping in for our usual hosts. Amina Rasul and Attorney Salma Rasul are currently committed and outside of the country, so they are unable to carry on their hosting responsibilities. So while they're away, I'll be taking over temporarily as a host for today's session. I'm thrilled to guide you through the discussion today and hope that it can bring the same level of insight and warmth that Amina and Attorney Salma has always done. Okay. So let me introduce our speaker today, Attorney Sol Diriquito Marwis, who is the current Dean of the College of Law of IUCM of the Philippines University, both in the Makati and Cavite campuses. She is also a founding partner of the Gatchalian, Castro, and Mawis Law Offices, handling criminal and civil litigation. On various occasions, television and radio stations have invited her to comment on legal and social concerns. She's also an expert and hence a bar reviewer in subjects in the bar for persons and family relations, evidence, and procedure. She is also a member of the working group of the 1997 revision of civil procedure. Welcome to She Talks Peace, Attorney Sol Marwis.
Good morning. Good morning, Attorney Mirabel Cristobal. Nice seeing you again through this podcast.
Yes. Thank you, Sol. Well, since we are going to focus on family law, just one question to start it off. In Philippine family law, what are the recent legislative changes, proposals that really captures the attention of the local Filipino audiences right now?
What to my mind is the burning issue right now is whether we should have a divorce law or not. You know, it has been, how many times? There has been at least 3 attempts, to the best of my recollection, where the legislature wanted to pass or adopt a law on divorce. And 3 times it has reached the Senate, but Senate was not able to, get the enough numbers in order to make it a law. And again, this is another attempt. It has already reached the Senate, and we are waiting on how the Senate will be able to handle this matter.
Okay. So looking at the composition of the Senate right now, because as you say, it's always been able to pass the House of Representatives, right? The first part, yes. The first hurdle. But it's always been in the Senate that it has been somehow met with opposition and has been delayed. Well, how do you look at the composition of the Senate now, considering that women are a minority in the Senate right now? Although the women who are in the women senators that we have are very vocal, staunch advocates, especially we consider Senator Risa Hontiveros, no? And we know that she will be fully backing the bill. But looking at her other colleagues, how do you think... And what do you think are the chances are that we, if the Philippines will finally get a divorce law, since we have been, it's been a subject of jokes that aside from the Vatican, we're the only country actually that has no divorce, although that has to be qualified because for those who live under Muslim personal laws, they do have divorce, but majority of the Christians and Catholics in the country are not able to enjoy the same, privilege of having, because there's nothing in our civil law for that.
You are very correct, Milabel. I think insofar as the women are concerned, maybe one or two have openly spoken about it and that they are willing to support the bill. However, there is one lady senator who said that she might not be able to support the bill because she has, a happy family. And then, he, of course, you have also our Senate president who, based on what he said publicly, appears not to support the bill. As to the others, they have not yet publicly shared their position on the matter. So at the end of the day, I think it's really a matter of numbers. How many will be able to say yes and how many will be able to say no? Right now, it's too early to tell because, as I said, majority of them have not yet spoken about the matter.
Oh, okay. I'll pick up on what you said. No, one of the senators said she is not inclined to vote or consider the divorce bill because she comes from a happy family. Okay, let's look at the impact of this kind of legislation on family, on the Filipino family. I want to understand what is the impact of a divorce bill, and does it affect saying that you have a happy family? So what does it mean? Does it mean that, you know, because you have a happy family, that divorce is far away and you should not be considering it as a law or as an opportunity for others who may not be similarly situated?
Okay. You know, those people who do not like divorce basically would argue that divorce is a threat to marriage as an inviolable social institution. By providing divorce, we are basically saying that we are no longer upholding marriage as an inviolable social institution. Now, and second, some of them would even go to the extent of arguing, okay, that it is unconstitutional. And then third, okay, some of them say that there are other, okay, alternatives to a loveless marriage. But with all due respect to those who are saying that, number one, it is a threat to the inviolability of marriage as a social institution, even the Supreme Court in a number of cases said that by granting a petition for declaration of nullity, it does not necessarily mean that you are going against marriage as an inviolable social institution. In fact, it is a means by which you uphold the inviolability of marriage as a social institution. Secondly, is it unconstitutional? Again, with all due respect, how can we say it is unconstitutional when our Muslim brothers, okay, do have divorce, okay, as a means by way to end a marriage? And then third, there are other means by which you end the marriage. But, you know, that kind of argument is neither here or there, because what we have right now is a petition for declaration of nullity of marriage, which means the grounds should have existed at the time of the celebration of the marriage, or void a petition for annulment, which means the grounds, okay, to render a valid marriage set aside because it's voidable. It can be annulled, but the grounds must exist at the time the parties exchange I-dos. And of course, we have the third one, which is a petition for legal separation, which you can live physically separate from one another, but the marriage is still intact. So here, divorce, actually, to my mind, is another option. It's just an option where you can terminate the marriage without looking back, without going through and reviewing what happened at the time you exchange I-dos, okay? All you have to focus on is what is the present. And if based on the grounds that, whether the grounds that are, if the grounds are existing at the time, during the marriage are present, then you can terminate it, okay? As I said, it is just a choice. At the end of the day, it will be the couple or one of them who will decide whether this is going to be what, terminated or not. You don't have to look back, as I said. It's going to be very costly. And we know that, you know, petition for nullity of marriage, even annulment, is costly. And then secondly, even if it's a petition for legal separation, you know, we all know this, it happens. There is such a thing as some marriages are really not made in heaven. Would you rather see a couple live in sin for the rest of their lives, or would you allow them to be free, okay, and precisely live in a more harmonious, okay, everlasting and loving relationship devoid of any sinful acts? So as I said, it's just a choice.
Yes, I totally agree with you, Attorney Saul, because, you know, sometimes there are situations where the marital setup is also already detrimental, not only to the relationship, but even to the mental, emotional health of not only the parties, most especially the children. Because most of the time, it's the children that has become a satellite battleground for, you know, warring spouses. But correct. On a social level, how do you think the absence or presence of a divorce law would be advantageous or disadvantageous to the women?
Okay, it becomes advantageous to the women, especially if number one, okay, all you have to do is talk about the present. You can get out of a loveless, abusive relationship by just arguing on the relationship at present. And then secondly, it becomes advantageous to the women if the woman and the man would agree, because the proposal is there can be a no contest divorce. You know, you can do this amicably, both of you, provided, of course, all the requirements of the law, okay, will have to be complied with. So it's advantageous at the end of the day to women, especially if the woman is at the end of an abusive relationship. Okay. She can go to court and just prove that there's abuse during the relationship and then can terminate the marriage instead of just being able to live separate from him and yet still be in chains of, you know, of that marital bond, because in legal separation, the marital bond has not been severed anyway. So it's like just living separate from board and bed, and that's it.
So what about, so if we have, we have a declaration of nullity of legal separation, but and these are just the vehicles of dealing with marital bonds. And if divorce is passed, then it's another vehicle. But whether it's a declaration of nullity or legal separation or divorce, it will always affect property rights and parental correct. Authority, because these correct. Are kumbaga riders in the marital and family relationship. So how do you with the present divorce bill and in your opinion, what is a good package or setup that should accompany a good divorce bill that will deal it fairly and treat parties fairly in terms of their property rights, and then insofar as parental authority is concerned?
Okay. Insofar as property relationship is concerned, whether the petition that was filed is a petition for nullity, annulment, or legal separation, and I think even in the divorce bill, it is already stated, the parties are really encouraged to come up with an amicable settlement or a compromise agreement as to how they will be able to divide, partition their properties. So to me, that is a necessary consequence of whatever you're going to file in court. Now, the same goes with respect to children, okay? The children as to who will have primary custody, who will have, you know, who will be able to exercise visitorial rights, okay? It can be discussed. Now, as to the issue of parental authority, that is quite a ticklish issue. Why? Because if the marriage is null and void from the very beginning, okay, except for Article 36, which is psychological incapacity, and the other type of marriage that is void, that is, you know, you marry but you fail to register the decree of annulment or decree of or nullity, then the general rule will apply that the children will be considered as non-marital children or formerly referred to as illegitimate children. Of course, then parental authority will always be vested with the mother, okay? And it cannot be subject to transfer, renunciation, or the like, because that is what the law is on the matter. Now, but with respect to visitation and custody, that can be discussed. But parental authority, that would really depend on the filiation, paternity and filiation of the child, which I believe under the law cannot be subject to any agreement.
Okay. So thank you for that, Attorney Saul. But now that these are changes in the legislative arena that we are looking forward to, well, what's in the horizon as well insofar as what we have been working for and advocating as women's rights advocates and gender rights advocates?
Okay, insofar as divorce is concerned, I think the mere fact that this is a burning issue, okay, should be taken into account by the Senate, because a number of women are really for it simply because, as I said, this will give them a choice out of a loveless and, more importantly, an abusive relationship. Not because you are in a marriage that is happy, okay, it does not necessarily mean that it applies to the others. And then secondly, with respect to the issue of violence against women and children, I think we are making headway as a country because we have RA 9262. We have this new law on open spaces. No? We also have many gender-based laws that will protect not only the rights of the women, but also of the children and also of the LGBT groups. No? Mm-hmm. So I think to a certain extent, we are, as a country, we are maturing enough. Okay, we're getting outside the traditional mode. This is the man, this is the woman, and that's it.
Okay, now we've talked about family relations first, and then let me veer you off to which is very central to family as well: juveniles, children, and the juvenile welfare. The family code has its roots with the civil code, which we know is came from our Spanish, conquistadores. But we have new legislations like the Juvenile Justice and Welfare Act and other new legislations that give premium to the welfare of children, right? Because previously, children are just adjuncts. They're just they actually are not almost not considered persons unless you reach the age of 18, or is even then, within the culture, not even can you exercise your rights if the elders do not allow you. No? So we have the Juvenile Justice and Welfare Act, which I think is one of the more progressive and has forcefully changed the landscape of how people, parents, society, and communities look at children. So what can you see further as, we see that it's there, but we need to improve it. There are some issues that have been hanging on its head. There's so many opponents to the way that children in conflict with the law should be treated, children, child soldiers. So what can you say as in terms of this issue these days?
Okay, the interest of the children is at the forefront, not only in terms of legislation, but also of judicial interpretation. If I may, in two cases, the Supreme Court in two cases upheld the best interests of the child. The first one is this case of Aquino versus Aquino, where in traditional, for the longest period, for the longest time, okay, as long as you are an illegitimate child, we have this what we refer to as the Iron Curtain rule. So you have the grandfather who was a child, who was a son, let's say, and this son was able to sire an illegitimate or non-marital child. Prior to the case of Aquino versus Aquino, which was promulgated sometime last year, if the father predeceased the grandfather, the illegitimate child cannot represent the interest of the legitimate father with respect to the estate of the grandfather, simply because there is a presumption that the illegitimate family is not welcomed by the legitimate family. So imagine that. Compare that to a legitimate child, wherein the legitimate father who predeceased the grandfather can represent the interest, of the legitimate father who predeceased the grandfather. But now, in the case of Aquino versus Aquino, And I would like to think that the Supreme Court really is you know, has veered away from the traditional mode of presumption of illegitimacy. There is a presumption of hostility between legitimate and illegitimate family. Now, as long as the illegitimate child, okay, has been welcomed by the grandfather, as based on that case, then that grandfather, then that illegitimate child can represent the father who predeceased the grandfather. That, to my mind, is monumental and very significant. The second case that was also decided by the Supreme Court, again, upholding the best interest of the child, is the case of Yap versus Yap, wherein a legitimate child, okay, can even question the his or her legitimate filiation and can go to court and say, I am not the child of this legitimate father of mine. I'm actually an illegitimate child of another person. Again, these two cases have what? Unsettled, okay?
to say the least.
For the longest period of time, they were considered as settled, almost cast already on stone. And here comes now the decision of the Supreme Court that really brought so dynamism, I would like to think, in, you know, in family law. Okay, yeah.
I'd like to follow up later on with questions on law reform and legal reform, especially that has been, you know, I agree with you that the present initiatives and the transformation of the Supreme Court in terms of how it now looks and deals with controversial issues, there have been people that that have been saying that, you know, you're supposed to only interpret the law. Right?
Yes.
As opposed to judicial activism. No?
Yes.
So what do you think? How do you look at the role that, you know, the pivotal role actually that the Supreme Court has taken these days in terms of law, you know, all these reforms, different sort of thinking and how it has actually affected the profession and the judicial system as a whole?
Okay.
You are an academic. I'd like to ask you there.
On a practical sense, of course, when these two decisions came out, immediately my reaction, oh, wow, what happened to the things I taught in the past? So it's a matter of doing things. But, you know, yes, of course, people would talk about judicial activism, that maybe it is not proper simply because, you know, it is like judicial amounting to judicial legislation. But, you know, at the end of the day, my major takeaway here is this. The Supreme Court opened our eyes to the things that needs to be addressed, to things that need to be addressed, need to be changed, and that there's now a difference in the factual milieu. Whether they are right or wrong, whether the decision is right or wrong, it gave us an opportunity to assess reality. That is there a need for us, for the legislature to really come up with a new law, amend, revise, repeal the said law, just to uphold the welfare of the children? Okay. At any rate, if the Supreme Court has spoken, who are we? We are just lawyers. We follow the Supreme Court. Whether that is right or wrong, as long as that is the decision of the Supreme Court, as lawyers, as public, as officers of the court, we have no choice but to follow what the Supreme Court has already said. But as I said, no, whether you agree with the ruling of the Supreme Court or not, we as officers of the court must abide. And if there is a similarly situated case that you want to bring it up, nobody will stop you, so that the Supreme Court can reassess and review its earlier decision. Because the doctrine of stare decisis anyway is not applicable to the Supreme Court, because constitutionally they can review, revise, and even, let's say, you know, abandon a previous ruling. But I hope the legislature will be able to perhaps review, okay, and perhaps evaluate certain laws, whether these existing laws need to be revised, okay, or be reassessed and reevaluated.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Now, let me bring you again back to the Juvenile Justice and Welfare Act. That, as I said picking up from what I've said previously, it has been controversial because it also prescribes a different manner of treating, handling, and looking at children, all the way from beginning up to the rehabilitation and even the social structures that should be in place. Oh, what can you say about how the brickbats and the issues still being raised to challenge this law?
Okay, to my mind, and I've handled a number of child-related cases, you handle children differently from adults. I think that's the fundamental basis of that law, no? We don't treat children like adults. Okay, and there is, I think one of the more controversial matter on that is the age of exemption, no? Whether you can be tried. I think if I'm not mistaken, now it's nine years old. Below 9 years old, you cannot be held criminally liable. And that's the reason why, okay, some people would, or even between the age of 15 below, as long as the child did not act with discernment, they cannot be held criminally liable. But we do know that even children at age 14 are now being used, okay, by criminal elements, because precisely these children, okay, will be able to skirt the law just because of age. But what is critical there is we must be able to determine, how do we determine whether a child really acted with discernment or not? I mean, that to my mind, okay, is something that has to be developed, that has to be made more precise, or maybe to guide us, no? Instead of just relying on, sometimes you just refer it to a person. But how sure are we that the parameters being used are sufficient to determine whether the child really acted with discernment or not? Some children, they do not even undergo written exams. It's always based on some, more often than not, just interviews, okay? So to me, that is the reason why it becomes controversial, the issue of whether a child acted with discernment or not. But as to the issue of whether you have to treat a child different and separate from adults, I fully support that, because children should not mingle, especially with quote-unquote criminal adults. We don't. They have to be treated differently.
Okay. Thanks, Sol. Now, this has been quite a discussion, and I hope our listeners are hooked, both here and abroad. Of course, we are looking forward to a lot of our listeners who are also in and around the Philippines. The Filipinos has become a diaspora. We are present in different parts of the world. But for a quick moment, I want to briefly thank them for all their support. And of course, any questions, comments, or thoughts, our host and our guests are much appreciated. You can send them to our email at shetalkspeacepodcast@gmail.com. And we have our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram She Talks Peace account. So don't forget to give us a follow. If you have any requests for topics or recommendations for guests, if you want us to invite them, please let us know. Okay? So looking ahead, legislative reforms and policy changes, how do you think, like we've talked about, of course, that we started to talk about divorce, and you've said that it's been languishing for so many, years in the legislature where it has not, moved forward. It doesn't end up as law. What do you think could push this? Because, I mean, several Congresses back and from between then and now, the change in mindset of a lot of people is very, very evident. And besides, because of the fact that the Filipinos have been all over the world and they have seen how it is in different parts of the world, a lot of us come back, with a different set of eyes. So, and now that we want to really push for this, what do you think should be the steps that, ordinary citizens, civil society, those who want to advocate for this? And I think the steps of the academe.
Okay, I think everybody's voices should be heard. Okay. If the Senate can conduct, a public hearing inviting all people from different walks of life, that would be good. We are not saying that those who are opposed to the idea of divorce, me personally, those who are opposed to the idea of divorce, they are not wrong. They are just voicing their own concerns and beliefs. I just hope that those who are for divorce will not be branded as wrong, but rather be understood using their own lens, no? It's different if you use your lens and then you try to understand the ideas of another person who are not of the same mind and thought. Then you will say they are wrong. It's not being a question of wrong. It's a question really of making sure that the rights and interests of, especially of women and children, whether this will be advanced or not. It is also not a question of really what is your personal experience, okay, that should guide you for voting against or for or against that bill. But rather really for you to best appreciate what is the sentiment of the majority. And the only way you can do that, okay, is, you know, make sure that you invite resource persons from all walks of life. Or for these persons, if they will not be invited, no one is stopping them. They can submit their position papers. And thank God for this kind of podcast shows where these matters can be discussed openly and publicly without really killing each other, okay? At least it's a very intelligent discussion, okay? It's very open, no holds barred, and yet with all respect. That, to my mind, is very important. Even if you're for or against it, respect must pervade, no? Otherwise, you'll not be able to understand what really is the issue because it will be anger and just, you know, a personal sentiment that will be understood. No, it has to be, there should be respect in the discussion, in the exchange of ideas.
Well, how about the academe? I think, you know, you're a dean of a law school, perhaps even in the different deans in the different law schools, perhaps there should be a movement or an effort also to reach out and send the positions to the legislators and specifically targeting those who are medium against and very intransigent in this, right?
You are very right. I think the only reason why the students were not as active in the discussion on this matter, specifically on divorce, it came at a time when everybody was already rushing to end the SEM, you know. It was towards the end of the semester when professors really have to make sure that they'll be able to finish their course outlines, and some are preparing already for finals. And all the focus and all the energies are focused on school activities, no longer outside school. Maybe now that the SEM is majority of the law school's SEM, the semester is officially over, maybe now the students will go back and discuss this matter again with openness, okay, and, you know, and they can precisely make their presence felt, you know, and they might submit papers to the persons in charge so that their voices can be heard.
Yeah, especially the student councils, right? Because yes. They are going to be the future adults. As young adults already, if you're a law student, you're a young adult. We have students that are actually married with children already, you know.
Yes.
They should assert the right to be heard, right?
Yes.
Anyway,
yes.
Let me veer off to the Bausi Law, another landmark legislation, and still highly controversial in terms of how it is being, they say, used and first from different point of view, abused by, you know, because it only favors women and all that. How do you now assess? It's been several years since we've had the legislation, and we have seen how many cases we have gone through using it and reaching the Supreme Court. What can you say about how assess the effectivity and the opposition to this kind of law, our anti-Bausi law?
Okay. The anti-Bausi law is manna for heaven for those women who have been abused. Okay, that's really manna from heaven. But it has also been abused because sadly, not all women, you know, tell the truth. Sometimes there's a tweak in it. Okay, and it is being used against the men. I think it's also about time for us to accept the reality that men can be subject also to domestic violence. I have had the occasion, okay, to handle certain cases where men were really subject to abuse, domestic abuse. It's not just physical. It's more of emotional and mental and sometimes even economic. And what mm-hmm. is now, and what is, why are we, if we're talking about equality, why can't we have the same kind of case, same kind of law that would favor the men? Okay. And that's the reason why, to my mind, we have to, again, move forward. There are husbands who can be subjected to domestic violence, but very few would come out in the open and report. Because especially in our society like us, no, like ours, the men will not report. They'll just suffer in silence. Compared to the women, okay, they are highly encouraged to report and even just go to the police station and look for the women's desk and report domestic violence. And immediately they'll be able to get what? A barangay protection order or even a temporary protection order. So that to me is something that should be looked into, and let's protect the men. Of course, okay, I have to say this in front of my husband, okay?
Well, actually, that's the essence of the debate there. Because, of course, through the years, no, of women empowerment, women's rights advocacy, women's rights enforcement, you have seen a big number of women really develop, bloom, stand up. More women, especially in this country, more women have access to education. That's already part of their path, right? But then still, there is, you know, not everybody has crossed over to the new thinking and embracing the new, you know, what the new developments. And then, as you said, there are men that are actually abused, but then they say, you know, men inherently are more dominant, patriarchal, stronger, etc. And that is why they say that women really need more protection, women and especially children. And that is why the Bausi law is very important. Because I remember when this law was in the legislature, there were several legislators who wanted to insert a provision that would say that, you know, equal protection. But that was always stricken down by the women's rights advocates because they said, in principle, yes, but in reality, men are stronger, more dominant, more access to resources. So has that changed right now from the time the Bausi law was passed and from how we see, I mean, it's been a decade or so, how we see society, Philippine society has changed.
Okay, we always claim, we always hang on generalizations. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, there are really people, especially men, who are what subjected to abuse. As I said, more often than not, they do not report this. They'd rather suffer in silence. But again, these are realities that exist. Now, yes, traditionally, and you always say traditionally, men are different from women. But these traditions, okay, are not necessarily true at this point in time. Okay, circumstances might have changed. And all I'm saying is give the men, okay, a chance also to be heard. Because there are really some women who are abusive, okay? And the trauma on the men is more what problematic because it's really psychological. There is no law under the revised penal code that would make the women criminally liable for psychological abuse if they inflict one on the men.
That's true. You know, it's human relationships is very complex, especially in the area of emotions and psychological connections, diba? So that has to be really looked into. Right now, okay, aside from the divorce law, what legislation affecting family law, women's rights, children's rights, what changes or tweaking the law that we already have, what do you think needs attention and priorities at this point?
Okay. one law that I really, really would like to see, or at the very least, a bill should be filed on this, because I do not know if a bill has been filed, is to determine at the very least the property relations of a same-sex relationship. Is it going to be treated as a partnership, a co-ownership, like under Article 147 or 148? Because we do not have, because the family code does not allow same-sex marriage, okay?
Yes.
So we cannot have same-sex marriages here. But let's, again, the reality is it happens, you know, there is a same-sex couple. What if one woman who is in a same-sex relationship is the only one working, and the other woman is the one taking care of the household, of their quote-unquote adopted children? Okay, now, this woman who is working is the one putting in the everything, the money, everything. What is the property relationship between the two? Remember, this woman who's not working is contributing to the maintenance and care of the household. Is that woman not entitled to even have a share in the salary of the woman who is the one who's working, or to any properties acquired during their union? So I was just wondering, is it possible for the legislature to even think of, at least consider, you know, filing a case short of legalizing same-sex union, at the very least, make a definition of property relationship? Because I feel sorry for the woman or the man who is the one left alone in the house, taking care of the dogs, taking care of the house, taking care of the food. And then there's the other couple, there's the other partner who is the one working. And yet at the end of the day, this woman or this man who stays at home will not have any property rights, will not have any successional rights. They cannot even demand support from their same-sex partner. So it happens. Again, this is a reality that we must address and must accept that it exists.
Yes. And then there's another thing that I'd like to raise and see. We know right now that, you know, because of advances of science, you know, surrogacy has been an increasing practice. And that is a real gray area, I know.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, there are so many issues that go around the surrogacy. That's not just simply having children, looking for a partner or somebody who will bear the child. But at the end of the day, there's going to be children, children's rights, family rights, parental authority, lineage, and all that. I'd like to ask you what you see as the development, you know, with this issue, with surrogacy at this point.
You know, the moral issue surrounding surrogacy is one of, and if I may use the word that was coined in one paper I read, it's womb for rent. It is paying the woman, okay, to bear the child of a man, and then later on, quote unquote, asking for payment. So it's the reason why it's called womb for rent. You pay so that this woman will carry your child, and then eventually when she gives birth, this child will be given to the couple. I think that's really a moral dilemma. I think that is not right. Why? Because you don't use your body and then sell technically the child to a couple. Okay, that doesn't sound right. But maybe let's study it, because there are some couple who would want to have children but can't. But at the same time, let's say there is a relative who's willing to be of assistance by just quote unquote lending the womb. Okay. Will you deprive this couple, okay, of the joy of having their own children for using the sperm and the egg of this couple and just implanting it inside the womb of another person? Because right now, under our laws, okay, it is allowed. Artificial insemination is allowed, provided it is done inside the womb of the wife. But what if the wife's womb is not also, it's not a good place, you know, for the embryos to stay? You need another womb, okay? But if it's the sperm and the egg of that woman, of the couple, is implanted on another person's womb, as I said, the only moral issue I see that really would stop me from even saying yes is when you now use that womb for a price. Because to me, that to me is it's something that is should be outside the commerce of man. Okay, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to use your womb and say, okay, you can use my womb, the highest, you know, highest bidder. That is a very big moral issue that we have to overcome.
Yes, I actually agree. And, you know, even with the opening of the borders before, you know, as you said, our law only has or discusses artificial insemination, and the treatment of artificial insemination was only a discussion between husbands and wives. But now you even have, you know, same-sex couples, whether male, whether female, also having children and family with a kind of setup, right? You know, right. they look for womb, even of foreign women, not just locally, no? So that they will have children that they anticipate will look better or this or that. I mean, that is an area of science that law needs to look into and really study. But how can the law actually catch up and keep in pace with all this, you know, scientific and issues and development? It is absolutely so difficult. Well, what can you say about that, Attorney Sol?
Well, to me, the only way we can catch up is if our own lawmakers will be maverick enough to tread the path of the unknown. I mean, they will be the ones who will prepare the bills. They will be the ones who will pass the law. We can initiate, but at the end of the day, those initiatives from, you know, people like us, you know, it will have to reduce into a bill and it will have to be supported by a lawmaker. So again, we go back to the legislature. Are they progressive enough to take on burning issues of the day so that we can discuss this openly? We cannot just limit ourselves into laws that would not really have a big impact on the lives of the Filipinos. Let's talk about possible areas that can be developed, okay, into a law, such as surrogacy, because it happens. There's so many people we know who really got into surrogacy. And what happens now? Will you adopt them? Will you adopt the children? But our present adoption law will not even allow that. Okay? You adopt a surrogate child? You can't. Because the basic rule in adoption now is matching. Of course, there are exceptions to the rule. But when the child is small, it's still matching.
Well, actually, that's true. And then you have the issues of parenthood. I'd like to share with you a case that I knew. I've talked to a woman before that she had a problem. She went abroad, but she used somebody else's identity. We know that. That's a practice that has been used by people. She used the identity of her cousin because she had to be younger. She had a child there, and then she got married to a foreigner. She had a child there. And then eventually she moved back to the Philippines with her foreign husband, and then she had another child here, but this time it's in her real name. Wow. So now you have a situation where you have one father, two children with two different mothers on record. How would you treat or how would you look at that kind of situation, Attorney Sol?
As long as it's not yet filed in court, I can comment. But if it's in court case,
it's not. But the problem was, what do we do? She was, you know, that was the lingering question is, what do we do? Because now you have one of the kids with the,
you know,
different mother, but the same father.
You know, I think because, you know, the mother cannot impugn the status of the child because that is her child. What you really have to do is really to seek a correction of the birth certificate of the child and prove that you are really the mother and that is your name, you know. But if, of course, it will open now to a possibility
a whole of herbs.
Yeah, because you know, imagine using a different name. But you can always claim you did it in good faith, and I don't know what the good faith there is. There should always be a solution to a problem, you know. Yeah.
Ay, nako. I know. The different, you know, the opening up of the world, the coming up of the different issues has really been, you know, opened different issues and concerns also for us to look into. And, you know, even as advocates, it's hard to keep abreast, right?
You know, yes. You know, I attended seminar before, a convention. It was about same-sex relationship. And then they started talking about the dogs. You know, the same-sex couple, instead of getting a child, they would always take care of their dogs. What happens if, let's say, they part ways? The question is, who will now, quote-unquote,
get that dog? Get the dog.
And if, for example, the dog is bred, it's a very expensive breed, for example, and it goes, let's say, to this person A, can person be compelled to give support to the dog, by who, by the way, they considered as their, you know, how would they call it, their child, because you know, if you are a dog lover, you don't call
the
dog
a child. I see
you
that.
You call the dog a child, your fur baby. Who's gonna take care of this fur baby? Who's going to support the fur baby? You know, all these things. Is there a custodial right over a fur baby? You know, again, all these things are matters which were not discussed before, but now it happens. Why? Because there exists really a relationship between boy and boy, girl and girl. Okay, and that is something that must be discussed openly and actually addressed also to avoid problems in the future. Well, that's a nice thing about having a... That's a nice thing about family. No, it's really not stagnant. It keeps on growing.
Yeah.
Are cropping up, you know. And really, our laws are not yet, you know, at par with the changes. And that's the reason why we have to keep on reviewing, reassessing, and reevaluating all our present laws.
Yeah, yes. Well, look at that. It's almost an hour. And I know time flies, but yes. Thank you very much, Attorney Sol, Dean Sol Mawis. As we conclude this episode, no, do you have any message that you want to impart to our listeners? Because we believe your experience and knowledge has been, you know, it's been obvious in all this sharing that you have.
The first one, I will always be salt to you, Milabel, because you've been a very good friend of mine. Okay, I'm not insult to you. Let me correct everybody. Attorney Milabel is one of the, how would I put it, better lawyers out there who knows what is right and what is wrong. Okay, and I am glad, though I'm not saying that it would have been better if it was Attorney Rasul, but you know, I'm really very glad that it's you, Milabel, who have exchanged ideas with me. Then the second is, you know, there are things in life. Life is ever changing. There are so many changes that sometimes our laws are not, our laws need to have to be reevaluated and reassessed because of the new demands, okay, of life. Hopefully, love will prevail in the end, okay? And that if we really want to be assured quality of life, then we should not get stuck with old notions. Sometimes it would be best to understand and accept realities. That's it.
Okay. Thank you, Sol. And with that, we'd like to draw the curtain on another enlightening episode of She Talks Peace. This is Attorney Milabel Cristobal standing in for our friend, Attorney Salma Rosul and Attorney Amina Rizol, your host for today's episode. And until we meet again, dear listeners, keep tuning in for more empowering conversations. Take care and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Okay.
She Talks Peace is brought to you in partnership with Podcast Network Asia and Podmetrics, the easiest way to monetize your podcast. For more information, check out their website at podcastnetwork.asia and podmetrics.co.
The The views and opinions expressed by the podcast creators, hosts, and guests do not necessarily reflect the official policy and position of Podcast Network Asia, the hosts of the program, or other programs of the network. Any content provided by the people on the podcast are of their own opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything.